This is tape two of the conversation with Stokely Carmichael. Continue.
Where were we? Oh, you were talking about going to Jackson, Mississippi, on the Freedom Ride.
A long walk into the waiting room. We faced a mob, and I was trying to look at people's faces. Meantime, trying to hold my suitcase up so I wouldn't get cigarette butts. They were flicking cigarette butts at us. And I kept thinking, why? It's a naive question. But it's something that still comes back, because you still can't find the answer. When you try to find the answer for questions that bother you, it's really a problem. Am I really, irritating people, and would it be best if I didn't really come? Will things really work out? Is it really my business, et cetera, et cetera? And all these questions were flashing through my mind. I got arrested, though. I got to know the jailer. See, everybody in jail, preachers, and very religious. I'm not. And they were praying all the time, singing. I'd sing, I wouldn't pray. I'd sit and read. We spent about a week in the Jackson City Jail before we moved to Parchment. Before we were moved, the night before, we found out that we were being moved from the prisoners below, who they were Negro prisoners below, so they thought we were great, heroes, etc. And they told us everything we needed to know. Excuse me. Yes, ma'am.
You were saying you were in the jail waiting to be moved to Parchment.
Right. Now, the jailer came up and he held the bars. And see, we gotten to know each other fairly well. I mean, us as a group, and he's an individual.
What kind of man was he?
He was an old man, about his early 50s, I'd say. Believed in the Southern way of life, for whatever connotation it brought to him. But he was an honest man, and he thought at first that we were just a bunch of troublemakers, agitators. We were just coming down to cause trouble. We were communist, et cetera, et cetera. And that he was going to rule with a ruthless hand, and that we were going to do as he said. He found out that we wouldn't do as he said. No matter what he did to us, we'd still keep singing when he would say not to sing. So after a while, it became a little petty game. He'd do certain tricks to try and keep us in line. Like, there'd be soup for a meal one day, and it'll be hot, and there were about, I can't remember how many, but let's say there were about 30 of us in there. He would pass 30 hot bowls of soup with about 3 spoons, and then say, I don't have any more, pass it around. So if you were last online, you just had cold soup. All these simple little things. But he found out that we wouldn't break under those little things. And it got so, as he'd even joke a little and laugh, and he'd say, you're going to be here for a long time. And we'd say, yeah, but you got to be here with us. Don't forget that. I think, I hate to use euphemisms, but I think we got to respect each other. Anyway, I got to respect him. After a while, the respect grew. And we got to respect each other very well, sort of. It grew because I respected him as a man, and began to forget that he was a white Southerner, that he was my jailer. Well, it came that we can really talk, about issues. And he'd tell us about what we didn't understand about the Southern way of life. And of course, he'd say the same stereotypes that Negroes were treated well, etc. And everybody would answer him with saying, well, that's not true, Negroes aren't really treated well, they're bad, etc., etc. We finally came to some understanding, I guess a sort of unspoken understanding, that we won't mention, our radical points of views to him. We'll just talk about other things. And I found out a lot through him about Mississippi and the way of life, that he used to go fishing with Negroes, etc., etc. And he thought it was equal footing. I didn't think it was an equal footing. I don't know. It might have been that something had bothered me. Well, anyway, the night we were leaving, or the day before we were leaving, he came to the bars and he held on to them very, very tightly. You know, and all of a sudden, he started talking about his life. He started talking about his maid. I can't remember her name. Let's call her Annie in stereotype. He said, Annie was good. She brought up and raised all my five kids. And we loved Annie dearly. It was a sort of deep, introspective thing about when Annie died, the whole family cried. They went to Annie's funeral. And every year, he places a wreath on Annie's grave. And he wanted us to understand that we were all wrong about race relations in the South. That they were really very good, and they were going to be better, you know, and the Negroes really liked it that way. But he was shaking. You can visibly see him shaking. And that, you know, we had our points of view as far as he was concerned, and he had his. He didn't want us to try and change him. He was going to keep to his way of life. He believed in God. And he believed in the way of the life of the South. He believed in human beings for what they were worth. He started crying. Tear dropped. And finally he said, I want you to know that whatever happened to you, you know, that you caused me a lot of trouble. That I can't go along with the trouble you caused me. But you're still human beings. And you have your beliefs and I have mine. And he left. I thought about that for a long time. Everybody else thought, you know, he's just, you know, putting on a show.
I doubt it. I don't think he would put on a show.
He didn't have to.
Let me tell you something briefly that Mr. Evers said in such a conversation as this. I asked him about the future of Mississippi, and he said, well, I think we can work it out. Otherwise, I wouldn't stay here. One thing, these Mississippians, said, the bullies and, you know, cowards everywhere, but said they are raised by and large on some notion of respect for courage. This is part of the code they are raised on. And when they see that we have courage and stand up on a point we believe in, they begin to respect that. As this respect is a basis for something that we can build on. They can respect that in us, and the things that we then we can respect. And though we may be against each other to the shooting point, there's a mutual respect possible. Second, he said, once this white segregationist crosses a line in himself and starts to deal with you, he won't lie to you. He said, he's crossed the line already. And he went on to say, he's not like, he said, the fella up north who will slap you on the back and say, that's fine, I'm with you. So he won't lie. So we have some basis for hope. Otherwise, I would leave the state.
Well,
does that make any sense to you?
Well, I think the courage part makes sense because my feeling is that people in the South are entirely different. They still have a sort of, you know, wild way of life. There are certain things that are dear to them. There are certain things that are dear to them. No, I never thought about the courage part as Charlie developed it, but I think there's something to be said for that.
For what it's worth, this is what he put on the tape. Let's go back to your narrative. We're left the jailer now.
Yeah, well,
singing to the bars.
I wanted to speak to him. He left. I wanted to ask him, what is he trying to say? Because I knew he was trying to say something. And I knew that he knew that we were leaving. And I want to know if he wanted to say we were leaving. He did say it because he said, no matter what happens to you, you know, I want you to know that, you know, you have your way of life and I have mine. And before he left, he turned around and he said, I don't know what's going to happen. He said, but I want you to know I want my children to have happiness and my grandchildren to have happiness. He said, I'm sure you all want the same for y'all kids. And he left. The next night we were moved out. And I didn't see him after that at all. We went to Parchment. And we had, at first, you know, they told us, you know, we had a big drill session early in the morning. That you're at Parchment, you know, and you're going to do as we say, the same thing. I saw the same sort of breakdown with the little fellow we used to call Sarge and a fellow called Sheriff Tyson. Sheriff Tyson once took our mattress away, and I thought it was unfair, so I told him I protested. And he said that he'd start with taking me first. So I told him he'd have to drag me out the cell, the mattress, and everything else. So he said he would do it. He said he'd do it by himself. He wouldn't get anybody to help him. So he opened up the door and started dragging me out. Well, he dragged me out in the hall and took the mattress away. And he said, now get back in the cell. I told him that I couldn't do that. You know, I'd have to resist him nonviolently. You know, he'd have to get me back in the cell. So he said, he's not even going to drag me. He got something that'll take care of me. So he got some wrist breakers, put on my arms. Those things really hurt, man. And he started twisting, and I just kept looking him straight in the face. He kept twisting and twisting and twisting. And he said, if you ain't a damn dog, as hard as nigga I ever met. He said, you gonna get in that cell? I said, no, I can't do that, Sheriff Tyson. I said, I think you're unfair. And all of a sudden he stopped. He said, unfair? He said, you mean to tell me you think I'm unfair? And he started an indictment against me of things. He said, now how could you say you're unfair? You sing when I ask you not to sing? You pray when I ask you not to pray. You make noise when I ask you not to make noise. You just think you're going to run my jail. I can't let you do that. Now, who's unfair? You know, and I thought for a minute, you know, he really believed in fairness. You know, from his point of view, I was being unfair. From my point of view, he was being unfair. So he said, now you say I'm unfair. He said, now you won't get back in the cell because I tell you, you're a prisoner. You're a prisoner. No. I said, yeah, but I want to be treated fairly because I was a prisoner. See, I was finding myself for once on the defensive, and I thought, damn, I'm letting this stupid Southern sheriff put me on the defensive. And so finally he called the trustee. He said, put that boy in the cell. And after he put me in the cell, I came back about an hour later. He was also visibly shaken. And he said, now, he said, I don't think you were right to call me unfair. And for once, you know, I forgot he was a Southern sheriff. Like, if we were discussing in a philosophy class the concept of fairness and justice, and he made an indictment against things that he'd asked us not to do, and we'd done. And I answered him by saying, yeah, well, I think you were unfair in taking our mattress because, you know, we have the right to pray. You don't let us have any ministers. We don't see our lawyers. You took away our clothes. You took this away without giving us reason. You know, he said, well, nobody asked you to come down here. I said, well, that's right. I've come down here, and you know, I'm going to accept the consequences, but I'm not going to accept them without putting up some resistance. And he said, well, that's always the trouble. People always got a reason. Well, you go on, because I have to resist, too. You know, and I wanted to ask him why. I've always wanted to ask him, why did he feel he had to resist? And before I could ask him, he walked away. Then I thought, well, why did I have to resist? And he walked away. We got to be sort of good friends, too, in a funny way. I spent about 49 days up there, and every time trouble started, he'd automatically come to me. And he'd say, now, this is what we're going to give you, this, this, and this, and this is what we want from you. It got to the point where we can really, like, it became a treaty, you know, we're going to give you this, we're going to give you that, you give us this, and you give us that. He'd always resort to his last tactics when he thought that we were being, you know, we wouldn't listen to him. And one tactic he resorted to was throwing people in the hole. He did this once.
Solitary?
Solitary confinement, yeah. And he threw Hank Thompson in the hole, who was in the cell next to me. And I started shaking the bars, because Hank was, can't remember what it was, some protest or something. And I called him back, and he said, now what you want? I said, Sheriff, I said, you know, you threw Hank in the cell, in the hole? He said, yeah, and he's going to stay there. And well, Sheriff, you got to put me in the hole, too. He couldn't understand. He goes, no, what's wrong with you? I haven't done anything to you. I said, now, that's between me and that boy down there. I said, yeah, but see, I think you were unfair, Sheriff. He said, well, if I'm unfair, it's between me and him. I said, no, Sheriff, you're wrong. It's not between you and him. It's between you and everybody else in the world. And so he said, you really mean you want to go to the hole? I said, yeah. He said, open up the door. When he opened up the door, everybody else banged on the door. And said, we all got to go to the hole. He couldn't believe this. So he packed everybody in the hole, you know. It's a good thing he let us out, because I don't really think we could have taken it. You know, we could hardly breathe. You know, he wouldn't put water. When we came out, you know, everybody was getting back to the cell. He said, you know, I think you're crazy. And I looked at him and smiled, and I said, no. No, Sheriff, you don't think I'm crazy. You think I'm too smart for you. He said, no, you're not smart. You're not smart. You're really ignorant. And then we went on to have a couple of conversations that didn't amount to very much. Except that one time when I was leaving, he took the pleasure of getting me out. You know? And he called my name last, and he opened up the cell door. And he said, "I'm glad to see you go." He said, "Are you glad to be gone?" And I said, "No, I'm going to miss you, Sheriff." He said, "Well, I'm going to miss you too, all the trouble you caused me." And I said, "But I'll probably be back, Sheriff." And he said, "Well," he said, "I'm not going anywhere. I'll still be here." And the sergeant says, a very sad voice, "I wish you all just leave everything alone." And Sheriff Tyson sort of nodded. And I wanted to say, "Well, I can't do that," but I didn't. I just walked out. But that was the only confrontation I had with white Southerners. It was the only time that I really got to see that outside of a mob, alone, they were just like, you know, we were outside of a mob. You know, I can go on a freedom ride. When the people around me, I'll say, "Oh yes, nothing is going to happen to us." When you get alone, when you're sitting on that stool by yourself and somebody's behind you, and you hear a knife clicking and hot coffee being poured down people's back, one minute you're isolated and you're alone, and you really begin to feel, you know, why am I here? When is it going to end? It was just before that first punch is thrown, just before you get hit, you know, that little period there, just before when tensions are built, and you can't control your stomach because it keeps jumping, and you start thinking over and over again. I think, you know, maybe that's the way it is when you're really alone, you know, when you really want to sit down and talk to people, when you really got to say, you know, let's just sit down and talk this out, Sheriff Tyson, just me and you, you know, and let's see, you know, where we're going. And you say, "Well, you can't do it." You always wonder why. You know, why can't I sit down and talk to Sheriff Tyson? Why can't Charlie ever sit down and talk, Medgar ever sit down and talk to Dilah Beckwith? You always wonder why. Go back to that. Well, after I got out of jail, I went to New York City for about 2 weeks, and my father and mother told me, "This is it. You know, you're finished. You've done your part. End it. Forget it." A week later, I found myself in Nashville, Tennessee. And, started voter registration at the end of the summer and went into Mississippi with Macomb County Liberty voter registration program. And from then on, it's just been...
That's where Allen was just lately killed.
Right. And from then on, it's just been... Now, there have been other developments. Yeah, there have been other developments since just the southern part. There have been other developments in that I, you know, began to find out that a lot of people who were just talking about civil rights were jumping on a bandwagon. And that's
who had been just talking about it,
yeah,
or who had now...
No, who had been talking about it and who are now talking about it too, you know.
But not acting, you mean?
Well, even if they're acting, see, one of the things that bothers me is that I'm all for demonstrations, but I think that people are beginning to have radical demonstrations or radical action without radical thought, see. Like, you question the proposal of busing people back and forth to Harlem.
Yes.
And you say, "Well, if I speak out against that, you know, Negroes will think that I'm betraying them." You say, "But I don't honestly believe it." You know, and if some,
in the busing system.
Yeah. And if some white person, if a white press would say to you, "Well, what's your opinion?" What would you say? You know, we say to them, "Well, you can't say yes because, you know, it's really nonsense."
I was going to ask you about it.
that's a question that's been bothering me. You can't say, "Well, you know, it's nonsensical." And you're going to say to them, you know, "These Negroes don't know what they're talking about, you know, because so many Negroes are behind it." Well, I'll tell you, you know, I'm against it. I think it's silly. I think it doesn't solve the problem, because in about 10, 15 years, you know, most of New York City will be, you know, all Negroes. Then what are you going to do, bus kids in from Poughkeepsie? It's not going to solve the problem.
Washington, D.C., you'd have to go to West Virginia now.
That's
to get
right.
To balancing.
That's nonsense.
Some Negroes, of course, say that it's merely a matter of a tactical device to dramatize the situation.
Yeah, but it's not solving any issues. It's not solving the issues. And if you're going to dramatize, I'm all for dramatizing issues, but you're going to dramatize them because you dramatize issues because you hope they're going to be solved. I don't think you dramatize issues just to dramatize issues.
There are two separate issues in this matter of New York, one being the quality of the schools.
Now, that would be a good issue.
But that's clear that they are inferior schools. There's no question about that.
I agree with that, because I worked in Harlem, and I know the schools. All right, now, I would agree. If they would say, "No, the schools are, you know, you send the poorest teachers, the schools are run down, et cetera, et cetera." Now, I'll agree to all that, if you're going to dramatize and ask for those issues. But now, when you bring in the question of busing kids, it seems to me you're being unfair, Because I think, you know, let's face it, Harlem is no picnic ground. You know, I don't think that Harlem is a place for race riot. Because one thing that Dick Gregory does say that's very funny but very true is that you don't have a race riot, you don't have a bad neighborhood or a neighborhood that's because black people are living there, white folks come in and they get beat up. It's not a bad neighborhood just because white folks get beat up. Because Negroes get beat up in the neighborhood too. The Negroes get beat up in Harlem all the time. So just because you're white and you get beat up doesn't mean that all the Negroes are beating up white people. It's a bad neighborhood, let's face it. You know, for whatever conditions that are, whatever produced it, it is. And you can't really and truly ask somebody to send their kid in there.
There's another argument on this side, on the side of the busing that I've heard, given by Negroes. All right, we suffer. We want the white man to suffer some,
oh,
too.
That's nonsense.
And if he had to send his children 2 hours a day on the bus, he should just share the suffering. He should spread the suffering around. Even at the expense of a 10-year-old child that is being bussed 2 hours a day out of his life.
That's nonsense. That's clearly nonsense. You can't, you know, I think that whole goes through suffering comes redemption, and I don't believe in that. I don't think anybody has to suffer.
Well, this is vengeful suffering, too,
right.
Saying let's pass some to the white man, make his choice, too, about being hauled around.
See, that's the problem when people jump on a bandwagon. And the funniest thing is to watch the rise of the Muslims in America. Now, Muslims, when I used to go in Harlem, used to stand on a corner on a stepladder and yell and scream the same nonsense they're yelling and screaming now. See Eric Lincoln, whom I don't think is a very intelligent man, or even a competent researcher, that other book, Black Nationalism, by
Udam.
Yeah, Udam is a way better book than his Muslims ever
much
been.
Much more thoughtful book.
Yeah, it's a competent book. I read his book in 1960. He came to Nashville to speak to us. The man is ignorant. Now, he wrote the book, and the white press read the book. Somebody got scared, you know, and they said, wow, we're not even aware of this. And they started writing in the white press. You know, Dick Gregory says something else that's very funny. Malcolm X never knew that he had 200,000 followers until the New York Times told him so. The Muslims got respectable, they got off the stepladder, they put on ties and jackets, and they became famous. Everybody's afraid to say that the Muslims are full of beans. Nobody says it. You know, Muslims are full of beans. They're never going to get a separate state. That's nonsense. They're switching one god for the other god. They're talking about Allah. And everything they talk is they present no solution to the problem. All of a sudden, Malcolm X began to be invited to speak on all issues on the thing. Now, I went to hear Malcolm X. I know Malcolm personally. And I tell him, you know, you talk, you keep your talk on your side, you can say what you want. I don't even think that you put me in a better bargaining position at all, you know, because you don't say anything. He doesn't say anything. Everybody's afraid to attack him. The funniest thing I read was an article by Loren Miller on the West Coast, a fellow from Vice President of the NAACP, wrote an article in The Nation about 2 years ago called A Farewell to White Liberals, which was a ridiculous article. He got pepped up with this black nationalism and said, goodbye, white liberals, we don't need you, you don't do anything for us. Clear logic shows the article to be ridiculous. And everybody started, the NAACP put out print, reprinted it, and passed it all over the country. It's clearly ridiculous. You know, when they were attacked by Malcolm X, instead of standing on the ground, they folded and absolved and said, we're friends, you know. People just jump on bandwagons. That's one of the things you've got to be worried about. See, once the movement becomes accepted, then you've got to worry, because people don't really look for real solutions anymore.
Well, there are a variety of types of leadership, clearly, in this, and different competing groups.
No.
That's only natural, I suppose. But what is your diagnosis of this division of leadership and division of policy? How serious is this as a danger to the movement?
I think it'll become more serious. I was in Cambridge in Princess Anne this weekend, and Gloria just got that food surplus thing to come in. And while I was at the house, about 5 white people called anonymously, and they said, you know, I don't play your racial stuff. In essence, they said, you know, I'm not for it, but I'm real glad that you got this surplus food, because your surplus food is going to be distributed on an integrated basis. They said, we've been needing this for a long time. And Gloria would inevitably say to them, Or would you speak out? And they'd say, well, I can't, you know, my husband, etc. But it proved one thing. It does prove that people are beginning to see beyond all of this nonsense, say, beyond this thing. They're really getting at what I consider real issues. You know, for instance, the Eastern Shore is dastardly poor. The Eastern Shore is dastardly poor. And if white people can really come out and say to Gloria, yeah, we're with you on this issue, it may mean there's breaking ground for more issues. And all the people who are splitting, for instance, what's that guy, Cecil Moore from Philadelphia? What is all this Klan nonsense about? What is it going to solve in the long run? You wonder, you know, if people are really opportunistic, you know, and that's something that bothers, I think, a lot of people if they're honest about the movement, you know. Like, you wonder, you know.
Well, you know the Reverend Glamison, is that the way you pronounce it?
Glamison from Brooklyn?
Yes.
Yeah, I know him.
You know him personally?
Yeah, I've met him once. I don't think he's very intelligent either. See, if you're really serious about it, it seems to me you've got to think about whether or not you're opportunistic, see. It bothers me a lot, see. If I see my name in the paper, I'm not sorry it's there, you know. You know, when Robert Penn Warren writes me and says he wants to interview me, I'm not sorry that he wants to interview me. I sort of feel good. And you got to wonder, well, which comes first, you know, the seeing or that? You got to take that seriously. Because, see, you find yourself saying a lot of things that maybe you wonder, you know, that isn't really true. You're just saying that because people want to hear it. And you don't want to do that if you're really looking to solve the issues. One reason why I respect Bob is because he doesn't do that. He doesn't do that. He says what he believes, you know, right or wrong, accepted or unaccepted, not right or wrong. Accepted or unaccepted, he's going to say what he believes.
He doesn't close up the official front, as it were. He will stay to his own position without worrying about the tactics of it or the consequences of it.
I said, that's one of the things that we have to be worried about. And the trouble is that you get an opportunist, and he becomes a rhetorician. He says things that are going to appease people. He's not going to really look for solutions. Now, everybody's all hyped up about this busing thing in New York. Is it going to solve anything? What is it going to solve? I want to know.
Do you think it's just a test of power on an issue, is meaningless as an issue?
I wonder if it's not just some people really are beginning to feel that, you know, Negroes are really united. Let's get on there, you know. You know, you wonder, what are the political connections behind everything?
Sure.
I always wonder about that. I no longer accept
you. Now, you're talking about the Negroes joining up or whites joining up?
I'm talking about Negroes.
It works for whites, too, joining up with the civil rights movement because it has a kind of fashion. Or a kind of winning team.
It certainly does. There's no doubt about it. You know, you're very suspicious about white people in the movement. You always wonder why, you know, why is he here? But then it really bothers you when you start getting suspicious about Negroes. And that's been developing more and more. You know, I get very afraid when I read the name of one person over and over again who's saying nothing, essentially nothing, and who's got the press following him around and saying essentially nothing. You worry whether or not they ever read anything. You know, I've heard people get up and talk about the Civil Rights Bill, and they've never read the Civil Rights Bill. You know, now how can you do that? How can you do that? Or they'll get up and give their opinion about what's going on in Mississippi, and they've never been there. And it all runs back to the same thing. It's those dirty old white people, you know, dirty old white people. If they just give us our equality and our freedom, you know. The funniest thing is ask somebody what they mean by freedom now, you know.
Well, that's one of the questions one asks always, what is meant by freedom now?
Ask them, what is freedom now? You know, we want it now, all of it. What do you want? The other most nonsensical thing I've ever heard in my life is preferential treatment for Negroes.
In what sense would you argue that?
Well, in sense number one, it doesn't solve any problem because you're not going to get the government to give you preferential treatment. Number two, that the Negroes who are getting preferential treatment are Negroes who don't need it. Who? IBM are going to give Negroes preferential treatment? They're not going to hire Negroes. They're going to hire Negroes who are competent. They have to. Who's going to get preferential treatment? Is the labor in the street going to get preferential treatment? Is the welfare, the personal welfare, get preferential treatment? How are you going to do it? Can you get the government to put through a mass preferential treatment? The answer is clearly no.
I have talked with a president of an insurance company, a white insurance company, in the South, who volunteered this to me. He said, I'm swinging to the policy of preferential treatment for Negroes. He said, I think we have to do this to take up some slack, give special training, and as a choice, take the Negro, that as a matter of social tactics, he said, to take up the slack, we have to do this. This is a man in a very high position in business, you see.
Now, is he afraid that his business might be boycotted?
No, he's not afraid. He's saying this is a policy. He's not advertising the policy. But he said, this is a policy I believe in as a matter of social good. He said, I think it's a matter of general social good to give preferential treatment when possible.
Now, see, on a broad basis, that can never work. Because what you'll be doing on a broad basis is putting white people out of jobs.
Yeah, sure. And it becomes another problem.
That's what it ultimately leads back to. Now, how do you get out of that hole?
As I was sitting in a cafe in Cambridge the day before yesterday, three or four white men, two of them unemployed, talking along the counter. And one said, I haven't worked in 6 weeks or 8 weeks, whatever it was. And the other said, I know why. Your face is not black.
So, you know, that's what it's doing.
Whether it's true or not, I'm sure it's not true, but the point is, this is the talk at the lunch counter.
Now, when they backed up into that corner, it seems to me, the only thing left for them to say, and what they have been saying, which I don't agree with, is that, well, you see, the reason why we need this is because we've been so long oppressed, you know.
It's back pay, you mean?
Yeah, back pay, you know. Pay on dues. You owe us this. And it's a drip right down from the Muslims, you know. Mm-hmm. You owe us dues. I don't know that anybody owes me anything. You know, I can't hold you guilty. And I don't want you to hold me guilty for what my father did. You know, I don't believe in the Bible that the guilt of the father is going to follow the children.
Consequences do follow the children.
They certainly do.
It's not guilt. It's consequences.
I agree with the consequences, but I don't think that you should be made to pay the consequences of the acts that someone else committed. The other problem is there are a lot of white people who just don't give a damn one way or the other about civil rights.
Yeah, sure.
And they're going to be paying for this. You know, if you want to make people pay, I'll go along with you if you can get me the right people. You know, if you say that so-and-so shot your friend, then I might think, well, and they say, let's go kill him. Well, I might think, well, that's okay, we'll go kill him. You know? But if you say to me, so-and-so got killed, and one of those people did it, let's go kill him, you're going to have a lot of problem proving to me that we should go just kill anybody.
This raised a very, very important question in my mind, and one that's really worrying me. I'll tell you about it. In my long session with Mr. Evers, he said over and over again, and I played the tape back a few days ago to be sure exactly what he said. He said, violence and bloodshed solve nothing. We must think of the future, build a society that we can all live in, white and black. Birmingham was a disaster, is a direct quote. And lines like that, with the notion of nonviolence, all sorts of pressures, but short of arbitrary reprisals. Now, a week later, less than a week, on the 17th of February, he made a speech in Nashville. Now, this was reported on the front page of a Nashville paper, and I was there on the 17th, so I had to leave town before his speech, so I didn't hear the speech. But this advocates non-selective reprisal. And reporters write this down, he said, according to the report of the National Banner. Now, I don't trust any paper, having been a victim of it myself, so unless I was there, I won't take it. He says, if a Negro is shot in Mississippi, we will shoot a white man. Not one guilty, or not one who has a symbolic role in that, but any white man. Next, if a church is bombed with children, we will bomb a white church with children. This is the direct quote. Now, I wrote him a letter. I said, I had a tape, and I played it back to myself, and I'm disturbed by this shift of view. He's not the kind of man who says, say something to me, and then say something just to play it to an audience. There's some change of thinking that's taking place, some change of feeling, or something's happened. I haven't heard it, but I said, I can't print just the interview with me without reference to this. It looks slovenly and stupid on my part. I want to put them just side by side and make this out to be without explanation. I hope that you would answer me, give me a letter, try to explain what kind of accounts the shift of view. I haven't heard from him yet. I've been away since the beginning. I've got time to hear from him. But I was deeply disturbed by this shift. I don't understand it, you see. He's this man's responsible man in a responsible position. But he advocated then in this Nashville speech quite clearly, not by implication, but quite clearly, non-selective reprisal. And I was really troubled by this on many counts.
Well, I might agree with him that violence and bloodshed itself, as an act per se, may not solve anything.
Yes.
But I think the consequences from violence and bloodshed may wake people up. I think that it, in many cases, is inevitable.
What I think is that it surely is a grave danger of its happening. I think there's no question about that.
Yeah.
But that is different from the non-selective reprisal.
I'm not sure that I agree fully with him on the fact that bloodshed and violence solve nothing. It's true that Birmingham, Alabama was disastrous, et cetera, but it's also true because of Birmingham, Alabama, there's a civil rights bill in Congress. So we're not quite sure that it was just, you know, nothing. Now, it's unfortunate that four children had to die. But it would have been more unfortunate if some Negro had bombed another church with other four children, I would think. I would have to think that because you wouldn't be getting the right four children.
There are no right four children.
Right. That's true. That's the second thing. Shade
of complexion in the world.
You wouldn't be getting the people who committed the act anyway. And I'm not sure that I believe in capital punishment. Now, my whole thinking was very shaken on the bombing of those four kids because I thought, you know, that John Donne says that the death of any man diminishes me because I'm involved in that. I read that when I was a sophomore in high school. It took me till I was about a sophomore in college to really understand what he meant and to really believe it. I do believe it. But I thought when those kids in Birmingham bombed that, yeah, I'm diminished, but they died for one reason. That's because they were black. No other reason. They were black. And that means I can die too just because I'm black. You know, and that diminishes me even more because that makes the threat very, very close. See, the fact that 6 million Jews died in Germany is a horrible thing, both intellectually and emotionally. But it's more horrible if you're a Jew. And it's even more horrible if you're living in Germany at the time those Jews are being killed. So it becomes more horrible for me because I'm black. The decision is how do you stop
it. It's bound to be more horrible. There's no way for it to be different.
I've heard Charlie say a number of ridiculous things, I think. Seems like if I criticize everybody. I don't know. I can't see someone saying something like that.
Well, I was disturbed in many ways because of the inconsistency here between these two things. Things are fluid. People do change their views because situations change. And I don't know what the line of events is between the 12th of February and the 17th.
Let's see, when did that girl get hit by the car in Jackson?
That was earlier. That was earlier. Yes, I got there on the 9th, 8th or 9th. This is, I think, on the 7th that riot occurred at Jackson College. Mm-hmm. And he was then getting the students off the street.
Yeah, I remember that.
And he there was a lot of criticism among some of the younger people because he had not
demonstrated. I disagree with his position on that.
Several kinds of discussions. Some people said we want one as a big blow up, a real riot, and then you know, God out, then nationalizing the God. Some said this will be a change for the Big Bang. Therefore, we should live without the false prophet's course, whatever the bloodshed are. Some said this would have, I'm gobbledygus. Mrs. Richardson said that if they were taken off the street, they should have been into a nonviolent session right away with the songs and the prayers and the explanations of the purpose and go right back out nonviolently. Yeah. So that there'll be no bottling up of emotion and confusion of motive. But they just send them off the street and nothing more was mistaken. But there are several lines of criticism that I've encountered on this, on his policy there, or his behavior. I asked him in the letter, I said, is this related to the pressure that you are under because of that event? Now, this is an impertinent question, but I mean, it's in the cards to have the question, have that question asked, if possible.
Now, see, there are all sorts of problems with Negro leaders. See, a lot of them don't really seriously think about the problem.
Beg pardon?
They don't really seriously think about the problem, the whole problem of segregation. See, that's something you've got to watch. Merely because someone goes to jail 17 million times, or merely because someone's brother is shot, there's no reason why he should be selected to be a leader, it would seem to me. You should select leaders because they have good programs, because they show you some way that is likely to solve the solution, you know. But just because, you know, they've been to jail and they've got good hearts, you know, there's no reason to pick them for leaders. I'm very disturbed about that, because it seems a lot of people are coming to bloom as leaders because they're saying a lot of things. I was very worried about that speech at
Nashville?
No, the one that I did at the nonviolence seminar. Yeah.
Oh, here, at Howard University, the one I heard.
Right, I heard a tape back of that. It seemed like I was really getting to the point trying to convey that Negroes don't really all love white people. And I was saying that to counteract a lot of things that Nelson and Lott and King was going to say that night. You know, that nonviolence is the way. And that's not true, you know, that we have to show white people to love us. Because, you know, it seems to me that that's not true. I think the issue of nonviolence becomes very important in the question of solving certain things. Yeah, it's not true that it's going to bring us closer together and make us love each other. You know, it does it in certain cases, and I'm not going to deny that. Eddie Dickerson from Cambridge, Maryland, a white fella, 2 years ago dragged me off a stool and kicked me in the chest about 7, 8, 9 times, you know. Really gave me a good roughing up. One of the roughest times I've ever spent was at the mercy of his hands. And that same night he came back to the church, apologized, said he was sorry, and started working in the movement. About the last summer, he was the fellow who the white owner was smashing the eggs over his head, the white restaurant owner, and kicking. He was the same fellow.
What's his background, for instance? Is he an intelligent man with education?
No, he's not.
No education, but intelligent.
Well, I think he's, I worry about people who can shift just like that.
Paul,
that's right.
Saul and Paul, you know,
yeah.
Luther, it's happened.
He doesn't have formal education. He decided that, you know, he was wrong. He didn't have any right to beat us up. And he apologized to me personally and stretched out his hand, and I wouldn't take it, you know. I wasn't sure, you know. Somebody just doesn't come off of stepping on you and then offer the hand to shake. Finally I took it, and he sat down. He said, you know, I'm not here to join you, he said, but I just want to tell you that the next time you're out there, you know, I won't be leading the mob, because, you know, I don't think it was right. Now, this happened personally to me twice. It happened once in Nashville when a white fellow did the same thing, and we all went to jail, and the white fellow did go to jail too. And he said, you know, I was wrong. He said, I don't believe in what you're saying. You can't change my mind. I'm going to be a segregationist till I die. But I don't think I should have been out there doing what I was doing. So, okay, that's agreed. And I agree. Well, okay, that's okay with me. That's fair ground. He said, now, don't expect me to talk to you. If you come out there next week and I'm in the crowd, I'll try not to be there. But if I'm there, don't expect me to say hello to you, or don't expect me to try and stop them, because I'm not going to do it. You know, that's their business, what they do. And the next week, he came back to the church. He didn't show up for the demonstrations. He came back and he said, you know, he was pretty disturbed about it. He thought there must be a better way. And he joined. We got him out of Cambridge and sent him to New York to CORE. And CORE gave him some sort of nonviolent training.
Just a Nashville man, or are you a man in
Cambridge?
In Cambridge,
Eddie Dickerson, right. And I saw him early this fall, and spoke to him for a while. He was still working with CORE. I haven't seen him since. But he's become a strong person in the movement. But see, those are only exceptional cases. You know, I don't think that you're going to teach people through nonviolence. I certainly think as a tactic it's very useful.
Well, you apparently taught 2 people through nonviolence.
Yeah, you know, but there are a lot more people you've got to think.
Yes, but how much do these 2 cases mean? There's no telling what they mean, is there, really, behind.
Well, see, it seems to me that nonviolence has worked for about 4 or 5 reasons. The first one was that, you know, the South didn't know how to deal with it. So there was always publicity, and white people were very bad. The second thing was that we didn't have to justify our acts in the beginning. See, the white liberal element will justify all our acts for us. We were just students sitting reading books. So the white liberal element, and even the same fellow, I can't think of his name. I was trying to refer to him in the beginning, I think he's from the Richmond Times. He wrote an article, he saw a sit-in and he said, you know, this is exactly what I saw. And then he said, you know, these Negroes came into the stores, he is a segregationist, he believes in separation of the races. And he said, at the very end, he said, you know, there's one thing that bothered me. He said, I saw those students sitting very, very still, very, very quiet, not doing anybody any danger, except they had no right to be there, he said. And they're in the inferior race, he said. And I saw the superior race, he said, my fellow whites yelling and taunting and spitting and acting like animals. And he ended the editorial. So, see, they had to justify our actions, because they had to admit that even though we were wrong, if we were wrong, just arrest us and let it go with that. But see, the South is getting smart now. It's not doing that anymore in many cases. They're not going to be, you know, they're getting smart. They're maneuvering through law courts. They're putting you in jail for long periods of times and charging tremendous bond money where you won't be able to get out. And they're making all sorts of legal procedures now. So they're beginning to deal and manipulate with you on your grounds. The other reason I think why nonviolence worked is because you had a small core of students. And it's, you know, you had a small core of students from Congress for Racial Equality, from NAACP, and they were all well-disciplined, well-trained students. But now you're not having that anymore. You didn't have that in Albany, you didn't have it in Cambridge, you didn't have it in Birmingham, you didn't have it in Jackson.
Ill-trained or not at all trained?
Not at all trained. You're having a mass movement, see. In the beginning, everyone was talking about this is going to be a mass movement. But it wasn't. You know, you just had about the same students that I saw in New York on a picket line, and the same students I saw in Mississippi behind bars, see. And the same people I saw in Cambridge. But now there's a whole town of Cambridge involved, and you can't tell that whole town of Cambridge to be nonviolent. In Mississippi, it's not just three or four students on a bus ride, you're getting thousands of people to go down to register and vote. And you can't tell them that when somebody shoots into their house not to shoot back.
See? Shooting into a house, shooting back is very different from assassination in reprisal.
Yeah, well, I don't know enough for assassination in reprisal. I don't know.
That's a very different act.
It certainly is, you know.
Dr. Henry's now sitting there every night with the rifles at the window.
I know that.
I've sat there with him, I mean, through a long session with the rifles at the window, so I know what's happening there.
I know that. But it seems to me that when you have a whole town like Cambridge, how can you discipline them to be nonviolent? You know? And what are you going to say to the people? You don't have the right to demonstrate for your freedom because you're not nonviolent, you're not disciplined. For instance, one of the hardest arguments that used to fight when the sit-in movement first started was that people demanded that you wear a shirt and tie and a suit to go on a sit-in, and I refused to do it. And then the ultimate question was, are you going to tell me that I can't demonstrate for my freedom? So those decisions are going to have to be made. So that ground certainly is going.
Well, organization and discipline are required for the success of any movement whatsoever.
Certainly. But the problem is this movement so developed that it can discipline people? I don't think it is. I sincerely.
What's the next move, then?
Well, I don't know.
The next move, organizationally speaking, or as leadership?
Well, now that creates a problem. I thought about that quite a bit. You know, how do you get leaders of a movement? You know? How did you get a John Lewis? A couple of people in SNCC sat down and voted for him. A couple of people sat down and voted for James Farmer. A couple of people sat down and voted for Roy Wilkins. Now when these people voted for them, they said, now this is your leader. People in Atlanta heard John Lewis speak and they liked him. And so they said, well, I'll follow him. You know, they didn't say it verbally. As a matter of fact, they had a silent vote. They didn't say I oppose him, so everyone thought that they accepted him. And that was all there was to it. Same thing with Roy Wilkins. But now conflict arises because John Lewis says to Roy Wilkins, well, we don't think the courts are going to do it. We think we have to get out in the streets. And we think we have got to push hard. And conflict arises when Roy Wilkins says no. So people have to say, well, who are you going to listen to? No. And the problem arises, what is the people in Detroit going to do? Are they going to listen to Roy Wilkins about what to do in Atlanta? Or are they going to listen to John Lewis about what to do in Atlanta? You've got all sorts of problems creeping in there as to what is to be done.
That's part of the history of every movement, isn't it?
Yeah, and the other thing that you've got to worry about, and something that's beginning to bother me, is that you're going to start getting politicking inside of the movement. And that's bad, see?
Don't you have it already, to a degree?
You've got it, but it's developing. It's really heightening now. And it becomes very, very bad, because once you have politicking within, you begin to lose focus on without, see? And that's bad. See, the real way, I think, to become a leader is to develop a good program and present it to people. I think you've got a good program, people follow you, if you make sense. But that means that you've got to start attacking all the rhetoricians.
Now, some people, for instance, I think it's the secretary of the NAACP in Boston, with whom I have not talked. This is, I've read it. Said that the trouble with the demonstrations now is that the element of overreaching has entered. So each one must be more dramatic than the one before. It's like American advertising, that the rational pressure is not the problem now, of maintaining the rational pressure for a goal, but making each one a stupendous and more stupendous and the super stupendous spectacle, that you are caught in the advertising escalator, which is an irrational force operating within the movement.
Well, I think it's not only within the movement, I think it has to do a lot without the movement too. For instance, 4 years ago, if three little students pulled a sit-in, every paper in the country would be there. Now, if about 500 students pull a sit-in, nobody comes.
You mean this is a part of the general quality of American civilization, American journalism?
It certainly is.
That is, to get the attention, you have to put on a bigger and bigger show. So this movement is a victim then of the whole American psychology of colossal.
You tell them one person got killed, and that doesn't make a difference, you know. See, now, if three other people get killed, again, it won't make a difference, because six have already been killed. You're going to have to get 10. See? You're going to have to get 10.
This then raises the question of cold-blooded Machiavellian manipulation of risks and drama and violence, doesn't it?
Yeah, and the question is, who makes the final decision?
It moves into that question. The logic of violence begins to emerge in terms of this process, doesn't it? The danger of violence.
And the question still boils down to who makes the final decision.
Yeah.
And then if you do make it, how will you know that people will follow you? That is a problem. Now, I think my own personal feeling about Mississippi is that, see, you've got to keep pushing people to register to vote. You've got to keep pushing now. You can't slack them off. But that the whites are going to start pushing back too.
Clearly.
And then what's going to happen? Now, if you're really being honest with yourself, you're going to say, well, there is a strong, very, very strong possibility of violence. And you know it. Especially if you work in the Delta. You know, we've been shot at, we've been chased, you know what's going to happen. You say, well, should we stop? That seems to me another question. If you're going to avoid violence, and the way to avoid it is for you to stop. Since
yes,
nobody else is moving forward.
The question of violence doesn't mean merely surrender of the issue, though, does it?
No,
the
it doesn't
avoiding
mean
violence.
Right, it doesn't mean it. But the other question is now, if we stop this tactic, what other tactic can we use that will be as effective? Now, you can't deny the fact that publicity is great help in the movement. You can't deny that fact.
Sure.
It certainly is.
This leads to the fact that without a climate of opinion among the white people in the country, the movement can't succeed.
And that is why it becomes essential that you don't start talking preferential treatment, because that little fellow in Cambridge, Maryland, who says, well, that's because your face isn't black, means what he says. In the long run, he's going to not even hate Negroes because he hated them before for whatever traditional reasons. Yeah, but now he has something real to hate them for. They are putting him out of his job. Now that becomes an issue. See, now they're going to be fighting in the streets. And they're going to be fighting over jobs.
Yes, that's the. If this comes at a time of high unemployment,
absolutely.
It becomes really another picture entirely.
The other thing now is that poverty is becoming popular. Everybody's talking about poverty. It's so great, everybody talks about it. Nobody sits down and produces a program to solve the issues.
How much is this matter a class matter and an economic matter behind the screen of race, of the race issue?
Well, now when I was in high school, I thought everything was economics. I was a freshman in college, I was convinced everything was economics. By the time I was a sophomore in college, G. Franklin Edwards, Dr. Edwin's sociology department, had a long talk with me. And we used to talk quite a bit. Well, everything isn't economics. There are other reasons, you know. If someone isn't realizing they're manipulated and they don't know that their actions are motivated because someone on top is motivating them, and this one, someone on top, that article that what's-her-name wrote in the Nation about SNCC people mentioned power structure without knowing what they're talking about. Well, I don't know if she's precisely correct.
Power structure has become a cliche now. Yeah, nobody uses it.
Power structure, revolution, demonstrations, and all these things. Freedom now, equality, human dignity are words I think that people just throw around without giving serious thought. See. Now, when you talk about power structure, you know, let's isolate, let's see, Washington, D.C. We decided to have a rent strike in Washington, D.C. We want to work on it. That decision was made, number one, because we think that there's need for emergency housing in the district. Tobriner gave a report to the Commission on Housing, et cetera, and said that there is no need. Now, we feel that he's wrong. So we documented. People have gone out and made surveys. And we're convinced among ourselves that there is a need. There's a need to have rent control laws in the district, because there are none.
What do you pay for rent for this apartment, may I ask?
$77.50.
Was it two rooms?
One little bedroom. Like
bedroom and then this room.
Right. Now,
does that include utilities?
Yeah. This is a good apartment, and it's a good price in Washington, D.C. A lady up the block named Shula pays $90. She lives on the top floor, and you can walk in the door and look right up at the ceiling. I've got all the...
Through the ceiling.
Right through the ceiling, right. It rains, and it leaks all the way down. She pays $90. Everybody else pays about $100, $125 in the building. Now, that's clearly too much money. Miss Shula is on welfare. The welfare cases in the district is handled very, very badly, because Congress handles everything. So you start saying, well, the way to solve these problems is to get the rules and all that, but you need home rule in the district, because clearly Congress cannot handle the problems of a growing metropolis as Washington, D.C. Now, you got to decide, how do you get it? You say, well, you can't get it through the courts because they've been trying that since 19-some-odd years, all right? So then you decide, well, the other alternative as we see it is that of mass demonstrations, mobilizing people, dramatizing issues. Now, there may be other alternatives. I'm not saying that they're not. But we see this one as the best one. So you decide to go out and have it. And we talk about the power structure, talk about the real estate board. Because the real estate board clearly came out against home rule. You realize what it means if you have home rules. When we say we're against the power structure in Washington, D.C., we're against the real estate board on that issue. When you say you're against other things, you're against, you know, low wages in the district for laundry workers, then you're against the owners of the laundry workers, clearly. So I don't think she's fair when she says that we don't know what we're talking about. We're talking about power structure. I think that we ought to, you know, stop using those words. I agree with that. See, within the movement itself, there's terms for development and defining issues and terms, clearly. Because you're not getting away with what you got away with before. You've got to justify your own acts now, see. We've got to justify a rent strike. If it was a sin, white, liberal white element would justify it. We wouldn't even be asked. They'd just say, we understand why you did this. Isn't it terrible? And you just have to tell about the horrible treatment you got. You no longer can do that. You've got to tell people in Cambridge why they shouldn't vote for an issue when you're getting a thing. I agree with Gloria's position. I thought that was a correct position. But you've got to justify your acts. And that's not being done. But it's going to be, I think it's being demanded that it be done. And that's why civil rights groups are going to be under attack more and more. That's why preferential treatment will be under attack. You've got to justify preferential treatment.
That is, more and more, their responsibility of leadership was not present even 2 years ago.
Absolutely right.
Another kind of leadership is in order.
Right.
Which, with a more closely reasoned philosophy.
Yeah, and someone who's really taking his homework seriously, as we
That's
say.
That's what I mean.
Yeah. He must take his homework seriously. You can't just get your name in the papers anymore, because the papers aren't going to say you're a good guy because you're a Negro. Yeah. They used to say that once. Now they're going to say, you're not a good guy anymore. Matter of fact, you're an idiot.
Of course, the argument is now, in some circles, some of those in which I move, yep. A white man criticizes any Negro's policy, someone turns on him, some other white person says you're another, you know,
bigot.
Southern bigot. This is a There's a whole world of cliches, you see, and social pressures that moves around.
Well, we sure are in a mix.
It's a mix.
We sure are in a fix and a mix.
Well, shall we have some lunch? Good. We can resume then. This is the end of tape 2 of a conversation with Stokely Carmichael, March 4th.